all of a sudden, Ricky Steamboat, so powerful. Look at this. One shot. That's look all it takes. Yeah, look at this. What does that say there? One. What does that say? Two. What does that say? Three.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Welcome to episode 72 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson. And today, we'll be taking a look at Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, so Jim Crockett Promotions from November of 1981, which I would pinpoint the date, but it kind of depends where you look for the exact date. Some places have it as November 14th, 1981. Some have it as November 18th, 1981, which is what the YouTube video has. And on the WWE Network, it has both November 21st, 1981 and November 14th. It couldn't really make up their mind. They have November 21st in the bigger letters and November 14th in the smaller letters. It's one of my peeves that I've established about the WWE Network is that sometimes the dates get a little jumbled, which I'll have to admit is a pretty small and minor and rather trivial quibble, considering all the great footage that they have brought to light over the last 4 years. That bounty, of course, includes the Mid-Atlantic collections that they've been dumping on the network over the last couple of weeks that covers the period just before this in 1981, and as I speak right now, they are up somewhere into 1985. It may have changed between when I'm speaking now and when this show drops on Thursday, but this is a very good period for Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, Jim Crockett Promotions. Of course, this is one of the better promotions dating back to the mid-1970s, one of the most consistently good wrestling areas in the United States during that time frame. But before I get all into that and maybe comment on the very funky theme, they love their funky themes in Jim Crockett Promotions. You got that one. Later on, you had the Worldwide Wrestling one, which had a similar sort of disco vibe to it. So enough about that. Let me get in my plugs real quick. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. On Twitter, give me a follow at GF Allentown Pod. And you are probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon to support Place to Be Nation website with your purchases. And speaking of websites, we recently had a relaunch and kind of new writing on the Place to Be Nation website at placetobenation.com, and I hope you're checking all of that out. But I would be very remiss, because after all, this is the Pro Wrestling Only feed, as the website prowrestlingonly.com has relaunched as of July 1st, and there is a lot of new content dropping on there on a daily basis, with 5 match reviews as kind of a this day in history. And I believe it is Charles who is doing all of these write-ups. And I encourage you to check out the new ProWrestlingOnly.com and his review of matches over time. I look forward each day to seeing what is coming next. And not only that, the classifieds section that has been added to ProWrestlingOnly.com. Be checking that out in earnest, because I'm always a fan of, even though I probably have too much memorabilia and stuff that is of a non-wrestling nature, I don't really have much classic wrestling memorabilia, save for my LJN figures, of which I have a lot more of those than the old Hasbro or whatever figures from the early 90s, of which I can find none of them. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, some of the older stuff, even from this era of Mid-Atlantic in 1981. Should also mention that to close the book on last week's show, which was on the original pilot for Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling that was taped in late 1985 and aired in 1986. If you couldn't get enough of me talking about the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, do check out the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing from this past Monday, where I joined Mike Crockett and Brian Malonis to talk for about an hour about the Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling, but GLOW, the Netflix show, much more specifically, which just dropped season 2 last week, as I had mentioned during my own show. I have watched a couple of episodes of the new season, so I will not be saying any spoilers or anything like that. I particularly enjoyed the first couple that I've seen. And do check out the show if you do have a Netflix subscription. I do think it's a very well-made show. And my quibbles about it that I expressed on the show are certainly minor. And, of course, do check out the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing on a weekly basis. And speaking of long-running weekly episodic podcasts, the Place to Be podcast next Monday, I believe it'll be, I will be appearing alongside Mr. Rosero and Mr. Criscolo talking about a Saturday night's main event from right here in Massachusetts that was taped in Springfield in April of 1988. And April 30th, 1988, and that one is actually notable for being the first one where Hulk Hogan is nowhere to be found. This is entirely built around the new undisputed heavyweight champion, Randy Macho Man Savage, and a few other matches as well. So I have not taken all of my notes yet. I have my old notes from my blog, section309.com, because I did a write-up on that Saturday night's main event a long time ago. I cannot remember exactly what I wrote. I probably wrote like a long jag about how we could have gotten the Danny Davis thing to actually work, because I think that's pretty much the last you see of him on a national basis. He's probably still on the syndicated shows, but if you recall, he ends up becoming a referee by the time 1985 rolls around. I have no baseball stuff to distract you with. I went to a low single-A game this past Sunday in Lowell, and of all the complaints I could have, it was the fact that, you know, you're right up against the protective netting behind home plate, but they had it too loose. So the netting was hanging down and it was hitting my beer cup. And I was very upset about that. And then I realized, oh yeah, that is like the ultimate first world sort of problem. Like, oh, I'm sitting in the front row at this baseball game, but and my beer is being touched by the netting. And I'm like, ugh. Then I thought, you know, let's have a little freaking perspective. Of course, the 4th of July yesterday, a little late for this sort of recommendation, but something for you to take under advisement for the rest of the summer, particularly if you have a grill, and you can certainly do this on a gas grill. I know some of you, like Rosero, have your smokers and whatnot to make this even easier. But if you're going to make ribs, don't do the baby back ribs. Go for the meaty St. Louis-style rack of ribs. You can pour that dry rub on there. I prefer to have a dry rib. I don't like to put the barbecue sauce on it when I'm making it, and I will load up that smoker box on my gas grill once every 40 to 45 minutes, probably 3 rounds of smoke, because it'll take about 2 hours and 40 minutes to make it at about 225, 250 Fahrenheit, roughly. Recommend hickory as your wood of choice, but you know, you can play around with it and you can do mixtures on that sort of thing. So that just kind of a quick barbecue tip. I know I had done a barbecue thing before, but that was on a pork shoulder, so this is just a completely different thing. Problem with a pork shoulder on a day like July 4th is you're sitting around for 9 hours, or you need somebody there just kind of monitoring to make sure that everything is fine with the grill. Whereas ribs, that's a 3-hour commitment at most. You know, you can rub them up much earlier in the day and then come back and make it at your leisure. So that's my holiday tip for a holiday that has already taken place. But, you know, feel free to use that for, oh God, we're a long way from whatever the hell the next holiday here is in the U.S. We don't get any in August. So, yeah, take that under advisement for Labor Day, but make sure you get your ribs from the butcher shop early because they do sell out of those St. Louis-style ribs. Now, Mid-Atlantic Wrestling, November 1981, whatever the date is. As I said, this is arguably the best territory of the 70s and into the 80s. This is a debate for another time, I think, and I feel like that this is something that somebody could put together a show on, which was actually the best territory of the 70s. And they created stars in Mid-Atlantic. And Flair and Steamboat are the two obvious ones that jump out. But they take guys who were stars in other territories, like a Wahoo McDaniel, who we see on this show, and make them even bigger stars. Sergeant Slaughter, he was already a big star from his run in the WWF in 80 and 81. He comes down to the Carolinas, and he has a run here. He's the United States champion, having just won a tournament at this time. Wahoo, of course, was already a star from Houston and the AWA, but the Carolinas is generally where he's most closely associated. As I had mentioned, there's so many of these added to the WWE Network recently, and there's really no rhyme or reason to how they just decided to add all this stuff. I'm wondering where the hell this was, because it was on, you know, WWE Classics on Demand or 24/7 or whatever it was, and I don't know why it took them so long to get to this. And it's something that's worth watching on an episodic basis, you know, just go through week after week after week, because the show is consistently entertaining. And I would love to sit and watch a whole bunch of episodes in a row. I mean, I often do that for the research for the show. The problem with that is I like to jump around to different areas, you know, moments in time and different promotions. I mean, I might be doing Mid-Atlantic 1981 today, but next week I might want to do WWF 1997. I honestly, at this point, I haven't made up my mind yet. But all the elements are there that you would want in a wrestling program. There are good matches on the, even the squash matches tend to be a little bit more competitive than in other territories. On the WorldCast podcast, they had done a What If show on Mid-Atlantic back in January when the drops of all these shows on the network had started. So I got a lot of background from Mid-Atlantic on the research from that show. So, you know, do check that out as well. The promos are really good on these shows. I mean, look at the guys who were in the territory at this time. Slaughter, Piper, these are A-plus promos. And the commentary here is also very good. Now, this is actually kind of a, I want to say a word about this, because, you know, David Crockett, you can either take him or leave him. And, you know, he is a bit divisive, and I did like the way he would react to certain squash matches. But just a word about Bob Caudle, because I've been thinking about him and heard people say things about him, and I've had conflicting emotions about him over the years. For example, you know, hearing other podcasts like The Lapsed Fan or Where the Big Boys Play, who have kind of trashed Bob Caudle for, you know, his work, particularly, you know, on these NWA super shows. But I'm going to defend him from this perspective, and he is very beloved by the people who grew up in the Carolinas watching him on these weekly shows or watching him on Smoky Mountain Wrestling into the early 90s. There's a duality of Bob Caudle that I don't think people are talking about, and I can't believe I just said the phrase duality of Bob Caudle, but this is what it is. You got weekly Bob Caudle, and you got pay-per-view Caudle, or super show Caudle in the case of something like Clash of the Champions. On a weekly basis, he's like a lesser down-home version of Lance Russell, and that's not a knock on him, since Lance is literally like the greatest of all time, so it might be kind of an unfair comparison, but he's the guy that I would associate the most with Lance Russell. kind of like, you know, if you can't get Lance Russell for your show, but you want that type of guy, you know, plan B, having Bob Cottle there wouldn't be too bad. I just think that if you isolate him in a spot like one of the Clash of the Champions, I forget the exact ones that he did, or Capital Combat 90 being a particular example, where he's on commentary the entire time, and he's a little bit low energy for a pay-per-view, in my opinion. So if you look at him from that perspective, I can understand where some of the criticism comes from. But what I don't like is when people will trash a guy for, you know, not being good in that. I mean, he shouldn't have been on the pay-per-views because there were other broadcaster options that they could have, you know, thrown out there. I don't think he was the best fit for that spot. But on a weekly basis, Bob Cottle probably should have been used maybe a little bit more, especially during that period where the NWA or WCW was using Jim Ross on literally every single show, probably around the time that Tony Schiavone took off of the WWF, which actually coincides with them bringing in Lance Russell to host NWA Pro, a show that he actually co-hosted with Bob Cottle for a while. So, I don't know. With Bob Cottle, sometimes I have trouble separating out the fact that he worked for Senator Jesse Helms, who by any measure was either a white supremacist or somebody who really, really did well to suppress his strong white supremacist feelings. I mean, you know, just look up Jesse Helms and you'll understand what I'm talking about. But, you know, sometimes good people work for bad people. That's how it goes. And God, don't I know that. But there's so much star power on this show. I mean, I haven't even gotten to Ricky Steamboat, who is a prominent person on his show with his feud with Roddy Piper. And as I had said last week, it's a veritable all-star team of WWF stars from throughout the 80s. Slaughter, Piper, even Jake Roberts makes an appearance looking very different. Not from the facial perspective, because he has the normal mustache, but the fact that he has a cowboy hat and appears to be a lot skinnier, you'd be certainly taken aback if you knew the Jake Roberts from much later on. Not to mention that he is teaming with Ricky Steamboat, and you think of their feud from 1986, and seeing two guys like that teaming together just always kind of comes off as a little weird. So with all that in mind, let's just jump right into the show. You know, I like that song a lot from The Police, Every Little Thing She Does Is Magic, which was actually at number 12 on this week in 1981. I used the November 14th of 81 American Top 40 for that. The only issue I've had with that song, and actually it's not even really an issue because it reminds me of something good, is it kind of is a sound-alike or a feel-alike to the Baltimore Orioles fight song, Orioles Magic. Like some of the Orioles Magic song came out 2 or 3 years before this, and I'm not accusing Sting of plagiarizing. All I'm saying, you know, hey, judge for yourself. Orioles Magic, feel it happen. Orioles Magic, feel it happen. O-R-I-O-L-E-S. Magic, 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 magic. So yeah, that's definitely, when they say magic over and over again, it kind of associating one song with the other. And to connect this back to the Carolinas, I don't know if you know this, but the Baltimore Orioles home territory actually extends down to North Carolina. So when I went to the Outer Banks in 2016, Masson, which televises both the Orioles and the Washington Nationals, the local telecasts were available in the house we had rented. So just a little factoid there. So our hosts for the show are Bob Cottle and David Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier, And he's got no beard, which is very strange. I've become very accustomed to David Crockett with a beard. But here he is at the studios of WPCQ in Charlotte, which is where they had moved their studio tapings in 1981. The station actually had become an NBC affiliate in 1978. And that was the same year that the station was purchased by none other than Ted Turner. And it happened to be the first news operation that Ted ever owned, predating CNN by a couple of years. And he had upgraded the news operation there and really sunk a lot of money in to make the station a lot better. The problem was he sold it in 1980 for obvious reasons, probably to focus more on his cable channel CNN, which was launching the same year, sold it to Westinghouse, which owned other television stations. I know they once owned WBZ4 up here in Boston for a while. I'm not sure if they still do. And Westinghouse kind of let the station kind of rot. It was rather unusual in that it was an NBC affiliate on the UHF band rather than the VHF band, so it was a higher number channel. And part of the problem, I think, might have been that NBC was a little bit in the toilet in the very early 80s, from like 80 to 82, and it took a while to rebuild when you had Cheers and the Cosby Show come along, and of course, they're, you know, Dynamite by the mid-80s. They actually had sold the channel, Westinghouse did, by 1984, by which point they're, I believe, gone. Wrestling is gone from the studios there. So to start things off here, we have promoter Sandy Scott, a fixture of Carolina's wrestling over the years. And he's here to address what is termed as problems, which I didn't know that this territory had a lot of problems. As I said, it's one of the better ones. They have plenty of star power. But, you know, much like the Golden State Warriors signing DeMarcus Cousins to a mid-level contract, you know, you're always looking to get better, even if you are the best. Now, to have Sandy Scott address it, well, might not be the best guy to be, you know, outlining things.
Help me out,
Special NWA representative matchmaker Sandy, and you're finding some problems around, right?
Yes, we have several problems around that we're looking into and hoping to find a settlement to them very soon. But my main concern right now is getting the best talent that we can in the Mid-Atlantic area, and I've been all over the country looking for it. And as you know, professional athletes are very highly paid. Your football players, your wrestlers, your baseball players. And we have offered them good money, and we hope that we can get them in here. But also, we have something that I'll talk to you a little later on about that we think that we can bring them in here, that's going to bring them in.
So that's going to be a special incentive, then, right?
Yes, it is.
All right, and we're anxious to find out about that. And Sandy, thank you.
I mean, sure, we have Flair, Piper, Steamboat, Wahoo, Slaughter, but what's one more? You know, let's throw the damn money around. I just can't wait to hear this dynamic individual come back later in the show and tell us what he has in store. But we have to go to our first match, which is Ricky Harris, the man who would go on to become Black Bart later on in World Class and a whole bunch of other places, facing Jay Youngblood, who, when I see the name Jay Youngblood, I immediately think of his premature death in 1985, but I also think of his team with Ricky Steamboat, which won the tag team titles on several occasions in the Carolinas. Died in September of 1985, so some 6 months after Ricky Steamboat had departed for the World Wrestling Federation. He had an ailment while wrestling in Australia. It said South Pacific, but his actual place of death was in Australia, which I guess would be South Pacific. He had pancreatitis, a bout of that, which led to a heart attack and other ailments, and that is what sadly ended up killing him. Between him and Rick McGraw, late 1985 was not exactly the easiest time in the wrestling business. We focus more on the deaths that have taken place more recently. I mean, especially that 1 month in 2007 when you had Sherry and all the others. But he comes or came from a wrestling family. His brothers, Mark and Chris Youngblood, or at least would work under that name. Their dad was Ricky Romero, a wrestler of accomplishment in the 60s and 70s, not to be confused with the Toronto Blue Jays pitcher Ricky Romero, who was kind of a big deal there for about 3 or 4 years. And I think he made an all-star team in 2011, and then he just faded off the map within 18 months. Kind of a weird baseball career if you want to look up his stats. And Ricky Romero was biggest in Texas in the 1970s, is where he made his name. And Jay's actual name is Steven Romero, and his gimmick is that of a Native American. In fact, he is being billed from New Mexico by the ring announcer, which I enjoyed simply because I booked a trip to New Mexico last week, where I'll be going in September, because when you don't have kids, the best time to take a vacation is that first week of school, because nobody is going to really pull their kids out of school to go on vacation places. And also, it's a horrific week for traffic in terms of commuting for that same reason, is that nobody is going on vacation. So I like to take advantage of that. I think I've been to Quebec and other places during that time of year. Take my word for it. It's a pretty good time to go. And on this broadcast, and this is something unique to Mid-Atlantic. They might have done this in other territories too, but maybe not this specific thing. The camera, they would do this effect where it would look like a photo negative right before the bell would ring. And then when you would hear the ding, the picture would then all of a sudden become clear. It's almost like something out of an aha video or something like that. I didn't quite... But it was kind of fun. It was kind of neat to look at. I actually paused my TV on the drawing or whatever you would call it. I should post that on the Twitter in the notes to this show. Youngblood surprises with a drop kick right off the bat and a pair of arm drags. So shades of his partner, Ricky Steamboat. They worked very well. I mean, certainly one of the best tag teams in Mid-Atlantic in the early 1980s. I mean, whatever. I mean, they got the damn tag team titles, I think, on, I think it was 4 different occasions. A side headlock takeover. And then Youngblood is actually pushed off when they get up. He's pushed out of the side headlock. But then he stomps and then hits him with a drop kick. Black Bart had done the drop down. I'm just going to call him Black Bart because that's what I know him as. Hit him with another drop kick, then another side headlock takeover. And of course, as I said in the intro, longer matches on Mid-Atlantic television, this is very different from what you see in Crockett in 1987 and 88 when they're doing the ultra annoying 30-second squash and then into a 3-minute promo and then back to a 30-second squash that was very monotonous. It's just really kind of jarring if you look at this same territory now and then. Crockett on commentary, he weighs in and tells us that the dynamic Sandy Scott has good news for us later.
I think Sandy Scott, matter of fact, I know Sandy Scott has a lot of good news for you wrestling fans. I think it's something that you've been waiting for a long time.
Oh, boy.
Sometimes David Crockett gets criticized for being over-enthusiastic, and this is not one of those times he's describing what might be in store for us later. Oh, what could it be? You've just built it up so well. I can't wait for this guy to come back and tell me what they're going to be offering for, like, somebody to be in this star-laden territory that is already making lots of money. Youngblood gets whipped into the corner, and Harris goes in but misses the SD Jones Memorial Charge. And then yet another side headlock, and I'm rolling my eyes. I'm like, what the hell? When did this turn into, like boring AWA or whatever? And I know I had said that the matches were a little bit longer, but and this is where Bob Caudle comes in handy, because this is where he makes a point that Harris is a bigger man than Youngblood. Youngblood's probably like 235 at most. Harris being like more like 285, 290. So he's slowing the big man down, getting him off his feet, wearing him down. The whole notion of the side headlock as the wear down hold still very much in effect at that time. Youngblood does get hip tossed, but then Harris, I notice whenever he gets in an offensive move, kind of like not a pure jobber, because he is getting some offense, he hesitates in going into his next move. So maybe I'm giving him too much credit, but there's a certain nuance to young Rick Harris. He hesitates and then misses an elbow. So what does Youngblood do? Again, another side headlock on the mat, which has broken Harris a finger to the eye. And then a big back body drop by Harris. And then a slam. And then he hesitates again and then decides, you know what, I'm going to go for a pin, but that only gets two. He sends Youngblood for the ride again, but he puts his head down. A cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. Well, I guess he's really not much of a veteran. I'm just going into my bit, whatever. And he gets chopped in the head by Youngblood, who is getting in the Native American offense. He fires up real quick. The axe handle chop, the tomahawk chop, picks up the win, which is sort of like he's down, Harris is, and he lands like an axe handle onto him, onto his chest as he is on the mat. When it comes to Jay Youngblood matches, this wasn't exactly Final Conflict, which was the tag match of him and Steamboat against Don Kernodle and Sergeant Slaughter. By the way, I really do not know the correct pronunciation. Is it Kernodle or is it Kernodle? Kernodle? Kernodle, let's call the whole thing off. But it doesn't matter because he's not even here. But yeah, it's not Final Conflict, which took place in 1983, but this will have to do.
Stand attention, Nelson. I have something to say to you. I have something to say to all those maggots out there. The promotion last week after I left this studio, I heard there was a big fat Indian out here telling you not only myself, Roddy Piper, Ole Anderson, saying that we were cowards. Yeah, we didn't have talent.
You know, I think Slaughter is actually right to be offended here, to be compared with somebody as reprehensible as Colin Coward. Oh, wait, no. They're actually calling him a coward, and that's what has him up in arms. And in case you didn't know, the Nelson that he's referring to there is Private Jim Nelson, who is kind of an underling, a lackey that he keeps around. And Jim Nelson would one day grow up to be Boris Zukov, his teammate at the 1990 Survivor Series in that horrible, horrible match that I enjoyed so much. And Slaughter says his piece, and he throws it. He asks for them to throw it to a videotape of Wahoo speaking.
Doesn't seem like anybody wants to wrestle me. Doesn't anybody want to mention my name? I wrestled one time on TV in 4 weeks. I came here. I don't think I've had a match over 3 or 4 or 5 minutes since I've been here. I beat all my opponents. Piper doesn't seem to want any of me. Ole Anderson doesn't want any of me. Sergeant Slaughter seems to want to avoid my name.
I do think Wahoo is making a good point as well. But to further illustrate my point, I have to go back to Slaughter and let him say his piece.
That's right. You heard what he said? That I was a coward, that he didn't have any talent around here. Well, I'm going on record right now with a contract. There it is, a contract with my name signed. Wahoo McDaniels, come on out here right now and put your name on this contract. I'll wrestle you right here on television. I'll wrestle you anywhere you want to wrestle me, Wahoo McDaniels.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
It's really true, because you got Slaughter, he's challenging this Wahoo McDaniels guy when it's Wahoo McDaniel who is actually wanting to face Slaughter for the U.S. title. So a little bit of a disconnect. By the way, I would have loved to have gone back and just done a montage of every wrestler who has said McDaniels instead of McDaniel. I think Tully Blanchard had. I think there's a whole list of them, but to go back and do that would be a real waste of time for like a 1 minute bit. Like when I did the gymnastics announcers a few weeks ago, like that took me forever to put together 45 seconds of audio for the show. It's kind of silly. What's not silly, though, is that Sergeant Slaughter, the U.S. champion, is up next in the ring, and he is facing off against a man by the name of Ken Hall, which, you know, just a normal JCP job guy from the early 80s. Not too much of note there. But Ken Hall is a great name, and it should have been a name for maybe Sparky Plug's tag team partner in WWF in mid-1995, perhaps even like a trucker gimmick to go alongside with the race car driver. I mean, his name is Ken Hall. He could, you know, he could drive a dump truck or something. You could have put him with Drozzy. Feel like that could have been a really good stable. Sergeant Slaughter might be, and every time I see him, I can't help but think of him in a greater historical perspective. And yes, this is a great run in Mid-Atlantic. He just got there. He gets the U.S. title almost right away after that 80-81 run in the WWF. But I just think of him, and maybe it's the Greatest Wrestler Ever project from PWO a couple of years ago, and just gaining an appreciation for him from that. I think of my three stages as a wrestling fan. In the 80s, I just looked at him as G.I. Joe and nothing else. All of his heel work, you didn't see any of that stuff on Coliseum video. So me finding out about that later through wrestling magazines, I believe it must have been, was something of a surprise to me. And then in the late 90s, when I'm watching, he's the stoogey commissioner for McMahon and all that, and he's just kind of an annoying character who, you know, could still work a little, but you think, okay, old man, get out of here. I mean, that was kind of the style during the Attitude Era in the late 90s, which is kind of, that's why I consider it a regrettable time for me as a fan, I guess. But now that I'm older, I'm wiser, I have proper appreciation for this guy who just at his peaks, and let's call his peak from 80 to 85, let's say, and 84, his best matches were in the boot camp match against Iron Sheik, which a lot of people say was like his last great moment as, I want to say, as a worker. But I'd like to, you know, give honorable mention. The Iraq stuff in 90 and 91 was certainly not in the greatest of taste, but holy crap, could anybody else have gotten as much out of that character as he did? Could anybody have, you know, gotten it to that point? I really don't think so. I don't think there's any, let's say, American that you could have put in that role and did as well as he did. And I don't think he gets points for that. I think it gets overshadowed by the tastelessness of it all. As a face or as a heel, he could do both at a really high level. And I've mentioned it many times that I think his 1984 babyface turn is one of the best timed ones ever, just because, and the mood of the country in 1984 in the United States, after, you know, we kind of felt bad for ourselves in the aftermath of Vietnam. 84 was kind of a year where America was ready to feel good about itself again, now that those commie bastards have boycotted the Los Angeles Olympics, and we're gonna win all the events, and we're gonna bleed McDonald's dry. I think it was McDonald's who had that contest that was parodied on that Simpsons, where Krusty Burger rigged it so that for only events that communists never lose, and then he ends up taking a bath on the whole deal. And the thing about Slaughter is he can actually wrestle, and he starts here with, you know, waist lock takedown. And then he starts working one area of the body. So his psychology is certainly strong as well, to go along with everything else that made him an all-time great. Knees to the gut, then a gut buster in the breadbasket, which one of my favorite Gorilla Monsoon isms is the breadbasket. I think somebody should certainly bring that back. Then he lands a backbreaker, although maybe he just kind of dropped them at a wrong angle and meant to go for a gut buster. But he then picks him up and just kind of drops him stomach first on the top turnbuckle, which was an interesting looking move. And then, just for the hell of it, I guess to remind us that he is a heel, he grabs Hall by the hair and takes him down. You know, just a reason to get in some illegal stuff to remind everybody that this is a brutal Marine drill sergeant. Then he starts working the left arm and focuses on that. So first he's working on the middle of the body. Now he's picked a body part, and he's just going to take this guy apart systematically. Slaughter has a very great clothesline, I think, as well. It's not quite at, you know, the Stan Hansen lariat levels, but still, I think it's a plus clothesline would be my scouting report on that. And the Cobra Clutch is locked in as he is audibly calling out for Wahoo McDaniel as sort of a taunt or whatever, whatever. And as I said, this would be a fantastic run for Slaughter in Jim Crockett Promotions in the Mid-Atlantic territory that actually concluded with that match at Final Conflict in early 1983. He turns up in the WWF again in April. I believe he debuts on the April 30th, 1983 Championship Wrestling, where he makes his return. And then within a month, he is in a world title program once again with Bob Backlund. And he and Bob had matches in 80 and I believe 81. I'm not sure, but I know that they had, I think they had an MSG series. And what he did in 83 was, if you look back on it, Backlund was doing the Harvard step test and he was doing it through the entire show, which honestly I found kind of annoying during Bob Backlund's Body Donna sort of phase. And Slaughter just beats the hell out of him at about the 40-minute mark, which is pretty smart because you waited for him to get tired so that he wouldn't fight back. But Sergeant Slaughter, guy that I will just never tire of watching in this time period or talking about.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Get a local promo for a show coming up on February 7th in Roanoke. So it's 2.5 months away before this show that they are building up to. I mean, you want to talk about long-term stuff. I don't know if I've ever heard a local promo for a show that far out, ever. I mean, usually when you see those old event centers on WWF television, it would be no more than, you know, 5 or 6 weeks at most. And this, like I said, it's 2.5 months. They're billing a car versus title match as Ivan Koloff is the television champion, but Jimmy Valiant is willing to put up his 1982 Cadillac for whatever reason, because there was a DQ in the previous match. Even though I'm having trouble finding Roanoke results for 1981 for Jim Crockett Promotions, but we have an Ivan Koloff promo here. And I've always enjoyed his work. It's effectively like the exact opposite of Nikita from a promo perspective.
This is right, Valiant. You're still after this title. You'll give up your Cadillac for this title. Last time I was there, you accused me of getting disqualified intentionally to save my belt. That wasn't the case at all. I just got carried away a little bit too much because I enjoyed beating on you so much.
I know he's a heel, but that's a reasonable enough explanation from Uncle Ivan. Like, oh, I just like really beating up Jimmy Valiant quite a lot, and I just got carried away, you know? And that would later serve as, you know, one of the main factors of why he would be hired by Paul Jones's army, because when they put out, like, the job posting on whatever 1984, 85's version of LinkedIn was, and they say, yeah, we're looking to fill positions for Paul Jones Army. Like, the number one requirement is must have experience in beating up Jimmy Valiant. And Ivan Koloff certainly met the criteria. The only problem with the promo is Ivan is one of those classic old school wrestlers that has the ridges in his forehead just from all the blade jobs over the years. And it's a little disconcerting. At least with Abdullah the Butcher, there's a lot of other disgusting stuff to sort of look at, like his man boobs and just, you know, how large he is. Ivan has, like, these slots in his forehead that remind me of those little machines outside, like a Toys R Us, where you put, like, the three quarters in side by side, and then you push it in, and then you get, like, a mini NFL helmet that comes out of there. I don't know why it reminded me of that. By the way, I am not a Toys R Us kid, because good riddance to that place. I worked there in the summer of 1996, and that is the kind of place where
if you're, you know, granted, I was under 18 at the time, but if you work there, you look forward to your 15-minute break when you're working a shift, but this is the kind of place that would schedule you for a 3-hour and 45-minute shift, just short of the 4-hour minimum to give you a 15-minute break. By 15 minutes. That's like the one thing I remember about Toys R Us, other than they did have a Toys R Us picnic one day where all the employees went up to this place and there was a softball game, and I hit a very long double against a shift hitting left-handed, which I was rather proud of because one of the guys who I had played Little League with had kind of groaned when he saw me go up there left-handed and right-handed. So I kind of showed him, and unfortunately is also one of the top 10 athletic accomplishments of my lifetime.
Is love so fragile and the heart so hollow? Shadow with the words impossible to follow.
Leather and Lace is a duet with Stevie Nicks and Don Henley that was going up the charts in late 1981. But every time I would hear that, I would think about how Stevie Nicks and Don Henley had a very public affair in the 70s. And apparently it was also known, but I did not know this until I read a book on the Eagles, which I think was called To the Limit. It came out years and years ago, I think probably about 20 years ago, that Stevie Nicks actually aborted a child that she was to have with Don Henley, and then later wrote the song Sarah about the unborn child. I don't know. I thought it was rather weird. Of course, there's a lot of weirdness between Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles, so it only makes sense when they would join forces. And she only acknowledged that fact about the song being written about the unborn baby years and years later. I want to say it was like 2014 or something like that. The article says that Nicks never had children, something she blamed on her cocaine addiction, which is kind of interesting because I was watching the Access TV show, I think it's called Rock Legends, on Fleetwood Mac, and Stevie Nicks said she was surprised later in life that she still had a nose based on all of the cocaine she had done. Speaking of somebody who could have used a little cocaine to maybe elevate his, I don't know. Maybe he should just stay off drugs. Sandy Scott, Mr. Excitement, is going to elaborate on whatever it is that he is going to offer to try and get even more people into the territory.
Well, as I said, we've traveled all over and we looked at all the top talent in the country. And they're all making big money, like football players and basketball players and baseball players. So to get them in the area here, we are thinking of something to do. And I think we have come up with something, an incentive to bring them into this area. What would anybody would like today?
When are they going to get to the fireworks factory?
Is get a 1982 Cadillac, $17,000 to $20,000 automobile. And we're going to put that up. It could be in a tournament. It could be in a battle royal. It could be in anything.
A new Cadillac!
Could be in a raffle. Could be in an apple bobbing contest. Could be in a gourd throwing exhibition. It could be anything. Literally, that they're offering this 1982 Cadillac, which apparently, from the earlier thing, that Jimmy Valiant already has because he's putting it up in a match against Ivan Koloff. I'm not entirely sure what's going on there, and the only record I could find of somebody winning a Cadillac at this point in time was Jimmy Valiant winning the Cadillac, even though he was already in the territory. So you'd think that this would only be open to people who aren't already there. But okay, it's a Cadillac. It's gotten the attention of all the people that are there. So it is at this point that Sandy Scott and Bob Caudle, they throw to footage of a Tommy Rich match from presumably down in Georgia, which makes sense because the two territories are side by side, so it's very easy for guys from Georgia to come up to the Carolinas and work there, and also vice versa. The thing that's interesting about the footage to me is that the referee is in all yellow. I'm not sure I've ever seen that. Maybe I need to watch more stuff from this time frame. It's no commentary over any of this, and I can't identify who Tommy Rich is facing, but 1981 Tommy Rich is maybe his hottest year that he ever had. Maybe Tommy Rich is the Fernando Valenzuela of Southern baby faces in the 1980s. Well, you know, his looks kind of betrayed him after a while, you know, the attractive baby face to all the ladies at the shows down in Georgia. Interesting sort of career in that his best moments were as a super baby face in Georgia or as a super heel in Memphis later in the 1980s, opposing Jerry Lawler alongside Austin Idol. Just kind of interesting. And 81, obviously, is the year Tommy Rich wins the NWA World Heavyweight title for only a handful of days off Harley Race. I think they only got to one Saturday TV where he was actually the champion, and then he lost it right back. Although he apparently did defend the title successfully once against Harley Race in the interim, which would be an interesting match to sort of see because the crowd would probably be expecting him to lose it right back or whatever. So they all kind of make their way out, all the super heels of Mid-Atlantic. And I've kind of given short shrift to Ole Anderson so far. I have not talked about him as much because he wouldn't be part of the WWF All-Star team of the 80s. For obvious reasons, his cantankerousness and all that business. But Ole was booking Mid-Atlantic around this time in 81 because he's coming off a booking sequence in Georgia, some of his best work ever, to put it mildly. The heel turn on Dusty Rhodes in the summer of 1980, which took a year to build up to, and is an episode that is certainly in the queue for me to do later when I want to go back to classic territory days, because that is one of the great angles. It's something I kind of want to compare and contrast that with Bruno and Larry, because it's the same year and also a top five heel turn of all time by any definition. So all the other heels, Slaughter and Piper, they're out there as well, and they want to talk to Sandy Scott because they got their eyes on this Cadillac that nobody has seen yet.
You just say Cadillac to these guys and their eyes light up like a Christmas tree anyway, doesn't it?
What do you think? I've never ridden in a Cadillac before. Believe me, I have ridden in a Cadillac hundreds of times. Thousands.
Thousands?
What do you think? You're such a big shot now because you got a Cadillac.
Yeah.
This whole thing really got me thinking about Jack Klompas from Seinfeld for whatever reason. Probably because there was a guy who looked an awful lot like Klompas who lived in my old apartment building, except he drove a Prius. He had the one hybrid car in the lot, and this is like 12 years ago when people didn't have them quite as much. In the footage, Tommy Rich gets the win with the Thez press, and they show Ole Anderson out at ringside, and he is very upset about it. And of course, Ole is going back and forth because he's booking the two territories. So Sandy Scott says that Ole Anderson is a bit of a problem, which is the way some people would describe Ole's personality later on in life. And Ole, the guys haven't made their way out to confront Sandy about this whole Cadillac, but the first one out is actually Roddy Piper, who is the Mid-Atlantic champion. They have to make distinctions between the different titles in this territory because while Flair is the NWA champion in late 1981, see, he's not really on the scene in this show. It doesn't become the Crockett-dominated title until after Starrcade 83, because Flair is more of the traditional traveling champion that you would know in the 80s. So the champion of the territory, the Mid-Atlantic champion, as I understand it, would be Roddy Piper. You have your U.S. champion, which is Slaughter, and then you have the tag team champions, which is the Andersons. So Ole is one half of that. But Piper, he sees that Sandy Scott is out there, and yeah, he's Mr. Electricity, but Roddy Piper is coming to save us.
You're talking $17,000. Don't look back, Jack, because RP's going to have that Cadillac. I am the number one wrestler in this particular place. I am the one number one wrestler in Canada. I'm the number one wrestler in Japan, in Germany, in any place. And I demand myself, I want a shot at this Cadillac. $17,000. I'd sell my grandma to the Hun for $17,000, Jack. So you just put me in the tournament, and I'm going to get me a Cadillac.
As I had mentioned, the other heels and Slaughter and Ole have come out to join, and they express their wish to have a Cadillac.
Then let's just announce the time and the place, whatever it might be, because I think I'd look pretty good in a Cadillac. After all, you're looking...
Me, Ole. I look pretty good in a Cadillac myself.
Could you believe that guy?
Bob Caudle recognizes what's going on and says that, is there a little dissension amongst these guys as they all want the same thing? And the heels kind of shrug it off at first. You know, it's early enough in the process that you don't really need to go to the mattresses over this entire thing. But Sandy Scott, he's got a little bit more here, and he wants to let these guys know that they're going to have competition just beyond Tommy Rich for this sort of thing. So he puts on a videotape, which the little TV behind Bob Caudle that he would point to, when, even though they're in the studio and the matches are happening directly in front of him, he would often point to this TV, which I think might be either A, showing off the technology that they had to, you know, impose something on that little square behind him that is like a TV screen, or maybe a subtle allusion to the fact that Bob Caudle is a weatherman and, you know, would do that while giving the forecast on the news. So they throw it to a videotape again of King Kong Mosca, Angelo Mosca. So, boy, am I happy to see him once again, albeit under really weird circumstances in Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling Show. And not only is it Mosca, but because it is 1981, the footage is from the World Wrestling Federation, a taping in Allentown. So we get a little slice of Allentown down in Charlotte, North Carolina. And the idea of what they're trying to do, of all things, is to scare the three heels by putting over how much bigger Angelo Mosca is than the rest of them. I mean, he's not that much bigger than Sergeant Slaughter. I mean, they're fairly comparable size. So they're going to frighten the local heels with an out-of-town heel who's going to come down from New York and take care of business. So, all right, that's okay. But you'll be shocked to learn that Rowdy Roddy Piper has something to say about Angelo Mosca.
I'll tell you something. What's his name? King Kong Mosca? Yeah. King Kong Mosca. Looks like King Kong got the strength of Fay Wray. Look at him. He's fighting a guy 40 pounds lighter than him, man. You want somebody to fight? You want to fight somebody for a Cadillac Jack? You're talking 17 grand. All those folks in there, they ain't got 17 grand between the whole batch of them, Jack. I got me. I'm going to drive me one big Cadillac. Then again, that's why I'm Roddy Piper, isn't it?
This segment was really fascinating, with the car and all the heels kind of arguing with each other. It's a different way to sort of present it instead of a face-heel structure where you have three heels and then you try to frighten them with a fourth heel and then you sprinkle in a little bit of 1981 Tommy Rich on top of the whole plate. And I guess, you know, you have a recipe for something down the road. What that is, who knows, because Sandy Scott can't explain it to us. As they said, it could be a battle royal, it could be a tournament, or they could just hand the car over to Jimmy Valiant or whatever the hell ended up happening. So we roll right into a promo with Jay Youngblood and Ricky Steamboat. And nothing too big here, at least from those two guys. Youngblood challenges Sergeant Slaughter for the U.S. title. Ricky Steamboat is focused on Roddy Piper because that is his issue of the day. And if that sounds like a great feud, of course it is. You have Roddy Piper, one of the A-plus top heels of the 1980s, and Ricky Steamboat, one of the A-plus top baby faces, not only of the 80s, but of all time. But in the middle of all of this, Jake the Snake Roberts saunters in to join his pals. And this Jake, as I had mentioned, is a little bit different. There's not as much of a gut. He's more of a cowboy. He has a cowboy hat. And he's going to help out his buddies, Jay and Ricky. And he's got a message for Ole Anderson as well.
Sure, they've got a lot of talent coming in, but I'll tell you honestly, Bob, I'm concentrating on one thing, one particular individual. He's got a belt, a Mid-Atlantic belt. His name's R.P., Roddy Piper. Yep. And I don't know what I have to do, say, agitate him, make him embarrassed or what, just to get a match with this man. The man that's going around telling everybody he's number one in the Mid-Atlantic area. Piper, all I want is a match with you. Let me use a phrase Jason used. Anytime, any place. The people have been writing in, signing letters, petitions, everything. They're behind me. And I'm going to need you even more. We've got to get this thing done and get it over with. I've got to get that match with Piper.
All right.
Yeah, that's all he needs is a few votes, man, to get this thing across. When you bring a petition up there with enough names on it, there's going to have to be something done. So, folks, help him out, man, because he deserves a shot. And you, Ole Anderson, you're the snake. You're the snake in the grass. And you remember, I'm going to mow you down sooner or later.
For me, when I think of Jake Roberts and Ole Anderson, the first thing that comes to mind is that last Battle of Atlanta clip, which after you had the Tommy Rich Buzz Sawyer match, there is a second match between Ole Anderson and Paul Ellering. And Ole is a babyface in that one. And in the aftermath of that match, with Ole Anderson's pants all split and everything in rather embarrassing fashion, Jake Roberts runs into the cage and attacks Ole wearing a red Pro Wrestling Illustrated shirt. And it took me a while to identify him as Jake when I originally watched it. But man, oh man, that probably means I should just go back and watch that again, because I'm one of the people who actually enjoyed the Ole versus Ellering part of it as much as the Tommy Rich Buzz Sawyer match.
Place Traditions, JT Rosero and Chad Gamble here. I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceTradition.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place Tradition Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Meet podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceTradition.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceTradition.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and HistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceTradition.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
For our next bout, we have would-be future Black Sports Online reporter Jimmy Valiant taking on Deke Rivers. And if you don't understand what I mean by that crack,
build that on me, baby! Because Davy Crockett, right here, is the best black athlete in the world!
I suppose he could have written for The Undefeated, that Jason Whitlock website that was supposed to come out years ago, that was supposed to be quote-unquote Black Grantland, that just never happened because sometimes Jason Whitlock can be a little self-destructive. I don't know. Jimmy Valiant. For more on that, go back to episode 42 in my theory of why Pez Watley turned on Jimmy Valiant in the manner that he did. I have no way of getting or understanding Jimmy Valiant's character in the Mid-Atlantic territory, where he's hugely popular. And maybe it's because I'm from the North and I don't understand Southern culture as somebody would who lived there, who grew up there. I don't get it at all. Try to sum up this Jimmy Valiant character that's there for years and years. He's not yet at war with Paul Jones's army. That doesn't exist until around 83. Of course, it lasts for like 4 years. How do you sum up that character in one sentence? You'd think that any good wrestling character you can just sum up in a line or two, but I can't do it for Valiant's character. And please reply on the Twitter or send me an email just trying to sum up what this character actually is. Like, is it, it's a vagrant from the north because he's billed from New York City? Is he just a homeless guy who likes to dance, who has a, you know, a messy beard and hair? Is he just a man of the people kind of character? I don't know. When I see Valiant, I see him as the guy in the Blues Brothers who, when they're playing at the when they're posing as the good old boys and they're playing Rawhide in that bar, Jimmy Valiant would be that guy in the bar who's the first one to get up onto the table and start dancing. I think that's what I kind of see him as. But I can't argue with anything that he did because he's wildly popular in this territory and was successful in other places he had been, whether it be the WWWF in the 70s or in Memphis or all these different places. His squash matches are not particularly interesting. It usually is just a back elbow followed by an elbow drop, and that's exactly what this is to put away Deke Rivers. So this is something that maybe I can kind of continue on the Greetings from Allentown journey, is trying to figure out what exactly Jimmy Valiant is, and maybe at some point I will see him in another territory. Who is not as hard to figure out is Roddy Piper, who is back with another promo, and he's got an issue with Ricky Steamboat, as Steamboat had a match at some undetermined time before. I was looking up to see when this match might have aired and who it was against, but I couldn't find it because the records could be a little bit spotty at times. More on that a little bit later.
See, Roddy Piper is getting just a little sick and tired of people calling him a coward, Ricky Steamboat. All of a sudden, there's all these letters coming in. People are signing petitions saying that I'm supposed to give Ricky Steamboat a title shot. Well, let me tell you something, Mr. Bodybuilder, Mr. Nerfballs. I got a little tape here I want you to see. I give you a shot. I give you a shot to all kinds of titles, and you just show them right here on TV, Jack. You show them what the Lion did to Mr. Steamboat, and I'll show you why I don't give you no title shot, Jack.
Cocaine's a hell of a drug.
So this tape is of the match that Steamboat had against Piper's henchman. He had said if Steamboat beats him, then he can have a shot at his title. The referee gets bumped on a back suplex try by Steamboat. And then Piper runs into the ring as Steamboat is on top of his man and hits him in the back of the head with an elbow. And then in a very hilarious sequence, Piper rolls him over and pins him as the masked guy makes the count. I don't know why that was so funny to me, that they just wanted to do a visual pinfall in that manner.
There was only one person covering Mr. Ricky Steamboat with my street clothes on, you see, Mr. Ricky Steamboat. I don't have to be stylish, Mr. Steamboat. I am stylish, Mr. Steamboat. You see, now I am the champ. I'll wrestle you in tag matches. I'll wrestle you tag matches. I'll wrestle you for anything but the title, mister, because you're going to have to earn it just like I did. You see, Mr. Steamboat, I don't have to impress you anymore. You have to impress me. That's why I'm the tagger I am.
That noise from the crowd that you heard is Steamboat hitting the ring to kind of, you know, challenge Piper in a way to get in there, which of course he doesn't. Really strange how Piper just keeps calling him Mr. Steamboat. It was 5 times in that one little clip. He must be looking at the New York Times style guide, which when you refer to a person, if you've ever noticed in the New York Times, it's always Mr. blah, 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 which was always annoying in the aftermath of 9/11 when they would talk about Al-Qaeda and they would always refer to, quote, Mr. Bin Laden, as if he should have been afforded that kind of status.
Well, let me tell you something, Gene Anderson and Ninja and this other fellow, I can't pronounce his name, sounds like a Chinese soup to me. And that's exactly what the two of you are going to look like when Jay and I get through with you.
Not exactly sure who Ray Stevens was talking about there. I thought I heard the name Choi Sun, which is some sort of leafy vegetable used in Chinese cuisine, but I didn't quite I'm looking for anybody who has an Asian name like that in any of the Mid-Atlantic results, and I couldn't find it, as these are more promos for this Roanoke show on February 7th that I find no evidence of actually existing, because there was a Greensboro show the exact same night. But later in this promo segment, we get billed a match between Ric Flair and Blackjack Mulligan Jr., who happens to be, of course, Barry Windham. But this is different Barry Windham than what you would come to know, because he has a brown mustache and brown hair, so he doesn't have the blonde mane that you would become accustomed to as he goes other places. We see him in Florida in 1983, back in episode 31. He has the blonde hair that he would carry through much of his career. So this is interesting how he's talking about a student and teacher relationship with Ric Flair.
Ric Flair taught me a lot of things, a whole lot of things, not just about wrestling, but about life. I've learned a lot of hard lessons by watching him and by him teaching me.
I'm not sure what these lessons that Ric Flair was teaching Blackjack Mulligan Jr. as a young man. Maybe something like, if you're going to flash an entire hotel bar and, you know, open your robe, get a little tumescence going downstairs so that they're a little bit more impressed with what's going on. I think that would be the extent of Ric Flair's advice. For Those About to Rock, We Salute You was the follow-up by AC/DC to their Back in Black album of 1980. It was actually released, this album, in November of 1981, shortly after any of the three dates that this show has on record. And that is the entrance theme for Baltimore Orioles closer Zach Britton, which I always think is a cool one to come in from the bullpen. Me personally, my coming in from the bullpen song, if I was a baseball reliever, would be Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap, at least until I became eligible for arbitration or free agency, when I could start making money, and then I would change to a different song. But it would just kind of be a commentary on the lower salaries of the pre-arbitration guys. Anyway, imagine being a closer on a team that lost 60 games before July 4th. So our feature bout here is the team of Jake the Snake Roberts and Ricky Steamboat taking on the Grappler and the Super Destroyer. So two masked men. So this is really kind of cool and has the feel of classic wrestling to it. The Grappler and Jake actually have a history together dating to Mid-South earlier in 1981, because Jake won the Mid-South Wrestling North American title off him at the end of June, but lost it only 4 days later to Paul Orndorff. So it would seem like he was something of a transitional champion. And by the way, if you are looking this the info for this card up on Cage Match or any of the sites where you would get results, I had thought that I was mistaken about this being taped at WPCQ, because on Cage Match and on Wrestling Data, this lists this show as being taped at WRAL in Raleigh, which is where it was taped before they moved it to Charlotte. And it looks different, the interview area, from the week before and the week after, for whatever reason. But then I wasn't sure, and then you get to the end of this show as they're rolling credits. So this is where the credit roll is actually kind of helpful. It says, production done at the facilities of WPCQ in Charlotte. So that is something, maybe put in a correction for those sites, because it's actually on the telecast itself. I need this sort of minutia to live and exist. I don't want to be necessarily the Cliff Clavin of wrestling podcasts, but I just need to know these things just for my own edification. When it comes to the territory association game, where you take a guy from the 70s or the early 80s and you say his name and you say, okay, which territory is this guy most associated with? For the Grappler, it would easily be the Portland territory, where he was one of the top stars in the 80s and also a booker there as well. However, there's something interesting about the Grappler that from the aforementioned cage match that kind of caught my attention. Not sure if you know this, but you can rank wrestlers for their career on a scale of 0 to 10. And somebody out there does not really care for the Crappler. Unfortunately, it's all in German, so I had to run it through a translator to figure out exactly what was being said. And I'm going to read that translation from the person who gave the Grappler a career rating of 0. And it says, something is definitely lost here in the translation. Oh my gosh, at WCWC shows, it was always possible to wrestle the cabin to sleep. And Dusty Rhodes calls it a slow and methodical style. I call it boring to get there. I think that's something than what was actually originally said. His partner, the Super Destroyer, is Scott Irwin, the brother of Wild Bill Irwin, who were the Long Riders in the AWA. You may recall a reference to them in the Wrestle Rock Rap by Kurt Hennig and Scott Hall. The thing, when I think about his career, it's tragic that he passed away in 1987, and it was not through any sort of drug abuse or anything that I can directly link it to, but he had a brain tumor, and he was only 35 years old. And as I get older, these things hit me a little bit harder because, you know, that's 4 years younger than I am now. So this match, as you get into it, and these are four named guys, so I'm expecting a good one here. There's a very fast pace early on. And with Jake Roberts in the ring, it's kind of unusual to see him because very used to the Jake Roberts slow and methodical psychology-based style. In a studio environment, maybe he doesn't need to do that here. And also, physically, he's in much better shape than he would be later on. Steamboat works the leg of the Grappler, but he escapes and then tags out. Super Destroyer in. Then he gets his left leg worked over by both Jake and Ricky. Jake locks in a toe hold. And another thing about Jake in this match is he's wearing trunks, which you never see him in the WWF wearing shorts or whatever. Even in Mid-South, as you get into 85 and early 86, when he has his big run there, he's wearing those weird sort of karate pants. Ricky and Jake very focused on working the leg. Ricky ends up on the wrong side of the ring momentarily, but he ducks and scores with a drop kick. Tag out to Jake, who hits a slam on the Grappler. That gets a two count. Side headlock, locked on by Jake, on the Grappler. And Grappler actually reaches over with his arm and tries to push Jake's neck down onto the mat to kind of, you know, force his shoulders down. And Jake actually bridges up out of that, which, again, this is in good shape, pre-injuries, maybe not pre-drugs, but pre-most of the drugs, Jake. And him bridging up there was quite a revelation to me. Steamboat is back in, and I'm thinking that he'll end up in peril at this point because this is Ricky Steamboat we're talking about. But no, he locks on a sleeper first, and the tag out to the Destroyer. Grappler gets over, and he does end up in trouble, Steamboat does, but only for like 30 seconds before tagging out to Jake. I'm just waiting for that heat segment on Steamboat, but it takes a while for this match to actually get to that point in terms of its structure. Jake hits the knee lift on both guys, Grappler and Super Destroyer. I was a real fan of the way Jake would do that move. It would just kind of be this really rapid sort of thing. It would look a lot more legitimate the way he would do it, I think, compared to some other guys. Jake gets Irish whipped, and he takes a shot at Super Destroyer, who is standing on the apron. Rather than letting Super Destroyer perhaps do the old Bret Hart Foundation transitional move where he puts a knee up into Jake's back, it's kind of interesting. It hit me that Jake is doing preventative measures to prevent them from cheating. See, he hits the Super Destroyer because he feels that he's going to do something to cheat as he's getting whipped over to that side. And that's the way they transition the match, rather than straight up cheating by the heels. It's the babyface anticipating that cheating and then getting caught from behind by the Grappler. thought that was rather interesting. Or perhaps I'm overthinking this. I don't know. And I guess Ricky Steamboat can't always be the face in peril for this. But after getting worked over for a few, Jake is up against the ropes, and he's being choked there. Kind of like when a guy is lined up in the 619 position for Rey Mysterio, or when Big Boss Man later in the 80s would hit that sort of leg drop over the back of a guy's neck.
He's got to keep that air supply cut off if he can. Hard with a knee into the back. They have really worked on his midsection and his air supply. Lost it.
They'll never cut off our air supply, I can assure you of that. Jake is put in a tree of woe, and the boots are put to him, and Steamboat makes his way into the ring to try and get him loose from the corner. The referee is kind of negligent here. He should be getting Jake's foot down, and it's nice to see a tree of woe that doesn't result in a chair being placed on somebody's face and then a baseball slide drop kick. I think I became too accustomed to that in the late 90s. Bear hug by the Super Destroyer, and Jake does a very logical move and just kind of goes for the mask rather than trying to break the hold, because psychologically that would distract a masked man. I mean, he's wearing it for a reason. He probably wants to keep it on and conceal his identity, so he'll let go of the bear hug in order to protect the mask. So very logical. But here is Roddy Piper and Ole Anderson. They make their way down to ringside, and they're just watching for now. They're not just going to run into the ring and, you know, do whatever. I mean, they're going to wait for their moment. And Jake is whipped into the corner, but he reverses it. Grappler is sent to the corner, and Jake scores with a DDT. And Jake Roberts hitting a DDT, you would think that, okay, well, that's it. That's the end of this match. But not in 1981. Things were a little different, including what it was being called.
It is almost like a bulldog. Roberts got the grappler in.
Really glad they ended up calling it DDT instead of, quote, some kind of bulldog maneuver. Feels like that's a better name, a little bit more visceral. Tag finally to Ricky Steamboat, who comes in and is a house of fire. And man, the 1980s were just a golden age of tag workers named Rick or Ricky between Steamboat, Martel, and Morton. I don't think you could get a better triad than that. He goes for a pin after, you know, his House of Fire routine, and he is pulled out of the ring by Piper, who has now finally picked the spot. Piper and Steamboat end up in the ring, but Piper, who is definitely more on the receiving end of some blows from Ricky, rolls away and runs away from the fray, and the match ends in a disqualification and the victory for Jake Roberts and Ricky Steamboat. A very fun match, fast pace, really good stuff from everybody involved. Then we go to a post-match promo, which has Ricky praising this is kind of funny in that Steamboat is, he first praises Piper for his video editing skills for the footage that was shown where the parts of it were cut out where Steamboat came back and all that, because he ended up winning that match.
I gotta hand it to you, Piper. You're a little smart. You cut off the majority of tape and only showed what you'd done. A very typical situation in your case. But with the help of the engineers here at TV, Bob, let's roll that film and show the people what really happened.
As he's showing the footage where he eventually beats his man, he calls Piper Casper, and as in Casper the Friendly Ghost, which I understand what he's getting at, but if Casper is a friendly ghost, doesn't that make him a babyface ghost? He probably should have chosen some sort of heel ghost. And seeing as though Ghostbusters hasn't come along yet, it can be a little difficult to kind of name a ghost who is a heel. I liked Casper the Friendly Ghost, but only as a young child. I don't think I would have been watching in 1981. It's some fired up stuff from Ricky Steamboat at Piper. And now, don't tell me. Granted, back few episodes ago, the episode actually where he lost the Intercontinental title and he did the anti-drug PSA, which came off as a little bit weird and a little bit awkward. don't tell me that Ricky Steamboat can't cut a great promo.
You brought that man in here to do one thing. He's like a bounty hunter, Bob. Just to hurt me, hopefully, in Piper's case, end my career, maybe ship me out or whatever. But it didn't work. I beat your man right in the middle of the ring, 1, 2, 3. I took his mask off. I lived up to the obligation. Piper, what more do you want? I want you. I want a match. I don't care how.
See you next week, fans. Until then, so long for now.
Shame he got cut off there by the disco-y kind of techno music or whatever the hell you want to call it. Because I could have listened to that for a couple of minutes longer. That kind of fire from Ricky Steamboat. And not the fire that they would make him spit out in 1991. I'm talking true babyface fire. He'd have matches with Piper to try and regain that title that he had lost to Roddy Piper on November 1st in Greensboro. But he would be unable to regain that title. And of course, Steamboat had other business going on with the tag titles, his team with Jay Youngblood. He had a lot of things that he could do potentially. He didn't need to be the singles champion of the territory. Piper would hold that belt for 6 months from the time that he won it before losing it the following May to Jack Briscoe. And they would trade it back and forth. And eventually, Piper would sort of move along in the territory. He turned babyface later in 1982. And that's how they wrap up. They roll credits, which was very helpful, as I said, in this case, for them to say that this was taped at WPCQ. And that is it for Mid-Atlantic Wrestling for either November 14th, November 18th, or November 21st, 1981, depending on your source. Podcast roundup segment. I've already mentioned a couple of my usuals, the wrestling podcast about nothing, because I was on the show last Monday, but this coming Monday, I'll be on the Place to Be podcast on Saturday Night's Main Event for April of 1988, but also the Our Vantage Point podcast this week had episode number 88 with a very special guest, formerly of the Beatles, Ringo Starr. Oh, wait, that was actually Richard Land, who just sounds like Ringo Starr. The way to differentiate it is, I believe Richard is a better drummer than Ringo Starr. Still have one more thing to cover here, and that is another exciting edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, there are 307 comments on this video, which has been up on YouTube for the past couple of years. I feel like these older classic shows get a lot of traffic from people who like to say that they watched this back in the day, or comments trashing the current product and saying this is much better. I prefer not to read those because there's so many of them and it's so very cliched. As always, these are actual comments left on the YouTube video in question. We'll start off with Steven Gomez says, Ivan Koloff's accent teaches me that the Soviet Union was apparently a small town in West Virginia. Well, Uncle Ivan was actually a Canadian man and not from West Virginia. I'm unaware of a West Virginia accent being different than some of the other regional accents, whether it be a Southern accent or the Pittsburgh Yinzer accent, as I understand it. I don't know. I'd have to read a little bit more about that. Dynamo805 says, can you imagine going door-to-door in your neighborhood asking them to sign a petition so Ricky Steamboat could get a Mid-Atlantic title shot? And yeah, I probably could imagine myself doing that if I was into Ricky Steamboat and it's 1981 and you live in an area of the country where many of the people still believe and actually cheer for the baby faces. A true baby face like Ricky Steamboat. MeCorp says, the best description of Roddy Piper I ever read was from an SI article from the mid-80s, which referred to him as a 250-pound yapping adrenal gland. That is awesome. I don't know about that description, because Piper is hardly 250 pounds, I don't think. Padge MF says, Sandy Scott and I both appreciate Rodney Piper. And that's a thing that's come up on the WorldCast podcast covering World Class Championship Wrestling with Colorman Jay Saldi, who is moonlighting as a wrestling commentator He's a tight end for the Dallas Cowboys. NFL was on strike in the fall of 82, so he had more time to do this. And he would always call Piper Rodney Piper. He felt very formal about it. Maybe it's kind of that, like the New York Times style guide that I was talking about earlier with the Mr. Steamboat and all that sort of business. And then finally, Brad Utterstrom says, is this the match where Jake the Snake supposedly accidentally invented the DDT when he tripped in while doing a front face lock to the grappler? If so, I'd say that looked pretty deliberately like a DDT. Maybe it's just ironic timing, as just a few minutes ago I was reading Len Denton's wiki that mentions this, and here I randomly stumble across this match. I think the reference to that is from something that happened in Mid-South. As I had mentioned, they had had matches in Mid-South wrestling earlier in 1981. However, Jake Roberts did not himself invent the DDT. I think that's something that's a little bit more up in the air, but he's certainly the guy that eventually would become most identified with DDT, save for the author Rachel Carlson and Silent Spring. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. As for next week's show, I'm not entirely sure. I haven't made up my mind as to what I'm going to cover for episode 73, which is kind of a big one for me, because 73, one of my favorite numbers. It was a number that I wore in youth hockey when I was 10 years old, and I just kind of latched on to that. The reason being, as they sent over uniforms that were numbers 63 through 75, and because I was the third biggest kid on the team, the jerseys were sized by like how big the number was. So I'm the third biggest kid. I end up with number 73. And I've kind of just held on to that over time and whatever. It'll probably be a WWF show from the golden era of 84 to 92. A lot of good stuff appearing on the YouTubes lately. If you go to the usual haunts on there, you can find some things like a Wrestling at the Chase, perhaps, that you haven't seen before that are always interesting to check out. Thank you so much for listening. And if you have a moment, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music for this show, as it helps in terms of spreading the word, even the same as word of mouth. But it provides something called social proof that people are listening to and enjoying this show, even, you know, in tandem with you subscribing to both Greetings from Allentown feed and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. So thank you so much in advance for doing that. And do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Want to take a ride?
No, thank you.
Come on, take a ride.
You want to take a ride?
Why not?
I don't feel like taking a ride. Do I have to take a ride?
He doesn't want to take a ride.
What do you think? I've never ridden in a Cadillac before. Believe me, I have ridden in a Cadillac hundreds of times.